Right, let's get going. I think most of you are in now. So, welcome to our latest Employment Law 101 session. Thanks for joining us live today. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with specialist employment and business immigration firm MPM Legal. We're based in the south of England and we work with companies that are all over the UK and, in fact, internationally. They have a common interest, which is helping people here in the UK. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning. Very excited that we're into 2 4-day weeks, not gonna lie.
No, absolutely. Yeah, roll on the bank holidays and the shorter weeks. I'm here for that.
And the
Just a
chocolate
couple of
eating fest that I'm going to be doing over the weekend.
what was that?
Chocolate eating
Oh
fest.
yeah. Easter eggs. Easter eggs.
Indeed.
Just a couple of housekeeping matters. As you've probably gleaned from that conversation, we're recording this on the 2nd of April, so everything we're talking about is accurate as at that date. Nothing we're talking about today constitutes legal advice. As a lawyer, I'm going to say always go and speak to a lawyer if you need specific advice on a situation. We are recording this session. You can get our recordings on the MPM Legal website and on Spotify, Amazon, Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you listen to your podcasts as well. So please do look out for those. So what are we talking about today? We wanted to do a session on something that we've had a few questions on only very recently though, and that is the Fair Work Agency. Now, this is something that's been set up to go live this month, April 2026. And basically, the Employment Rights Act 2025 reforms have brought in the Fair Work Agency to centralise and strengthen enforcement of employment rights in England and Wales. So you think about this overall theme that we've got with the Employment Rights Act 2025, which is really all about rebalancing the power in the employment relationships and essentially shifting it away from companies and trying to give individual employees and workers more powers. And this is the enforcement part, or one of the enforcement parts of that move. So the Fair Work Agency is going to have proactive powers to investigate, recover unpaid wages, and penalise employers and those, unscrupulous businesses who are not compliant with the law. So we wanted to do this session and talk about why these changes have been introduced, what the purpose of the Fair Work Agency is, what powers it's going to have, and what it means for you as employers and people leaders as well. As always, if you've got any questions, just fire them out as we go along. I'm going to fiddle with the chat function in a second, but there is a Q&A function that you can drop your questions into. But Adrienne, what are you going to tell us about the FWA?
Well, I thought we'd start off just talk a little bit about its purpose, what's it there for? But I mean, as everybody knows, in most cases when employees have got complaints, they've got internal mechanisms, but then in terms of external mechanisms and enforcement, the onus is on the employee to bring their claims to an employment tribunal. And there are a limited number of circumstances in which the state, the government, can actually enforce employees' rights, such as in respect to things like national minimum wage, and there's protections for agency workers. Now, I think in last time's session, and I wasn't here for it, but I think we were talking about the state of tribunals generally. And as everybody knows, anybody who's involved in employment tribunal litigation or has read it in the news, they are currently overloaded. And just to give you an example of that, this week I received notification of a preliminary hearing. So that's your first case management hearing for a discrimination claim, because it seems that discrimination claims obviously are going to take longer because at the moment they need a full panel. And the preliminary hearing on this case, where the defence, I think, was put in probably December, the preliminary hearing has been listed for October. Now, wait for it, October 2027. So that is the first time that the parties will end up before a judge talking about what the issues are, and only then will there be a timetable set for litigation. So I would imagine that case could easily end up in hearing for 2029, even 2030. So we know the tribunals are, as I said, overloaded. And the Fair Work Agency should hopefully take some of the pressure off of the tribunals, because as I said, that's currently the main option for employees to pursue any breaches. Tribunal processes are complicated, expensive, lengthy, and it can often mean that breaches such as underpayments, they go unchallenged. So the Fair Work Agency will have some of this stuff brought under its remit, but essentially it's bringing together some of the existing enforcement functions. Now, those of you that get involved with businesses that have na national minimum wage issues, you'll already know that this is currently enforced by HMRC, who looks at pay. I mean, it makes sense from a tax perspective. Then we've got things like the Employment Agency Standards Inspectorate, and their responsibilities are to regulate employment agencies and employment businesses to protect agency workers. And then we've got the title that always interests me from a sort of a historic point of view, the Gangmaster and Labour Abuse Authority. Now, that's they're the enforcement agency that investigates vulnerable workers. So there we're looking at modern slavery, worker exploitation, human trafficking. Now, I would like to think that nobody on this call will ever have been caught in the crosshairs of this authority, but it is out there and it does have enforcement powers. So the Fair Work Agency is going to bring all of those together under one roof. Now, aside from the national minimum wage, probably the most important thing that we wanted to highlight today is that additional areas of enforcement will be added at a later date, as yet unknown, to be covered within the remit of the Fair Work Agency. And those additional areas of enforcement we know will be holiday pay, payment of holiday pay, and payment of statutory sick pay. And the Secretary of State's going to have powers to add in other enforcement functions into the Fair Work Agency to allow coverage of other employment laws. So this is marking a real shift away from employment tribunals jurisdiction in these areas. I think it's quite significant. It will also cover unpaid employment tribunal awards. Now, I know that a lot of tribunal awards, compensation for unfair dismissal, etc., there's an awful lot out there that while the employee gets the award, it very often isn't paid. And I haven't done an enforcement of award for many, many years, but I think the situation at the moment is that it's really complex to get the money out of the company, but usually involves registering a judgment in the county court, if I'm right, Peter, tell me if I'm wrong, and then it's enforced that way through bailiffs, whatever, etc., all the rest of it. Now, it can be really tricky. So, Peter, tell us a bit about what powers this Fair Work Agency is going to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I do, we did indeed do a session 2 weeks ago on the current state of the employment tribunal process. We touched on how AI is having an impact on that in terms of the issues we're seeing kind of pre-litigation phase and how that's feeding into how claims are actually run, particularly by litigants in person. So if you want to catch up on that session, it is live on Spotify. Just search Employment Law 101. You'll be able to listen to that recording with myself and our colleague, Charlie. So it's a good one to listen to in terms of timescales the tribunal are dealing with at the moment. But yeah, in terms of the FWA, the powers they've got, you know, what they can do, obviously they're empowered to do something. So they're empowered to investigate and they're empowered to actually take action if they identify a breach of the law. Now, for the first time, employees who have complaints about things like underpaid holiday will not actually have to go through the tribunal process. And, you know, question mark whether it's going to be a shortcut in effect because of the delays that we see with the tribunal, although something like an underpaid holiday claim might be something that's listed sooner. But there's a different avenue open. And I suspect the way that we'll see it used is in respect of large scale employers. So where there's an issue of, you know, hundreds of supermarket workers or retail workers, just to pick two, you know, random sector examples, you might find the FWA looking en masse at a particular sector or industry or large employer if they think there's an issue. Now, actually, a lot of the Fair Work Agency's powers are based on existing enforcement bodies' powers. So it's a bit like a consolidation of that power, really. But there are some new powers that are introduced. So let's just run through what they can do. So first of all, they can inspect workplaces and they can require employers to produce relevant documents and evidence to demonstrate compliance with employment law. Now, that isn't anything new as a concept. So that's based on existing powers. And there are businesses out there, hopefully you that are joining today have not been involved in any that have been on the receiving end of an inspection and a sanction. But there are bodies already that can go and look at whether you're compliant. And, you know, we see it also in terms of immigration provisions, don't we, Adrian, where UKVI or Border Force, whoever's responsible, will go in and do certain audits and investigations. So similar to that. Secondly, there's a civil penalty regime. Now, that's been taken from the National Minimum Wage Act, where if an employer's found to have underpaid workers, notices of underpayment will be issued, and employers will need to pay the workers their due and a penalty to the government as well. So, kind of double whammy, double incentive to get it right. Now, we've probably all seen circulated, I mean, I see them on LinkedIn periodically, that list of businesses where HMRC have issued a non-compliance with national minimum wage. Employers are visibly named and shamed. And, you know, when I see the link, I will have a look and see if I recognize any of the businesses that are on that list, because it is a really random bunch. And we've seen high profile retailers get caught out in recent years. I mean, certainly around national minimum wage, there was an issue around what constituted provision of a uniform and if a requirement to wear certain colored jeans and t-shirts amounted to a uniform, who was paying for that? And actually, when deductions were taken into account, was an employee still getting their national minimum wage? So sometimes it can be easy to get unstuck if you're flying close to the wind in terms of how much you're paying. Anyway, slight aside there. Third point, the FWA will be able to bring proceedings in the Employment Tribunal on a worker's behalf, and they'll also be able to offer legal advice and assistance where somebody is or may be party to civil cases relating to employment or trade union law. Now, I'm not entirely sure how that's going to work in practice yet, and kind of to what extent they're going to be getting involved in individual proceedings. So time will tell on that, but they're going to have the power to be able to do that.
They're surely going
Four.
to be looking, sorry, just to interject there. They're surely going to be looking at sort of, as you said, class actions
Yeah, you'd
in
think so.
reality,
Yeah, the
because
larger stuff.
otherwise, can you imagine the amount of personnel needed for the Fair Work Agency to be able to bring claims on behalf of each individual worker? So it's surely going to be large timescales. I mean, one of the queries I've got over that is how that's going to fit with the existing limitation periods,
Yeah,
because we all
quite.
know that these type of compliance investigations audits, they take some time. And so, you know, I'd be very interested to see how those two meld together.
So the fourth power is there'll be an enforcement regime in respect of labour market criminal offences, which involves voluntary labour market enforcement undertakings and compulsory labour market enforcement orders, where employers are required to correct their behaviour. Now, they're very serious. Breaching those types of order is an offence which can result in fines or imprisonment. So, you know, they're kind of the top end of the seriousness. And I think that's going to be to do with things like worker exploitation, maybe into the realms of, you know, gang master activity, you know, the sort of stuff that's been reported in the media in recent years. Fifthly, the Secretary of State can create regulations which stipulate charges the FWA can impose to recover enforcement costs from employers who have had enforcement action taken against them for non-compliance. So you've got the FWA going after employers for non-compliance and then can charge those employers for having to go after them, which, you know, makes sense. Now, that's just an ability to create regulations. So I haven't seen any regulations yet which stipulate those charges. So that'll come out in due course. They can look back 6 years. So quite a long period. And this, you know, dovetails with that announcement where a lot of people were making a fuss, I think, about, oh no, we need to keep holiday pay records for 6 years. I think most employers keep decent holiday pay or holiday records anyway. Yes, maybe you need to adjust how long you were planning to keep those records for, but it fits in with why. And you know, part of the answer to the question why will be the Fair Work Agency having the ability to look back 6 years and saying, hey, we want to make sure that you've complied with the law in this area. So there's some logic there. And finally, this is an important point as well, which is there doesn't actually need to be a complaint for them to start an investigation. So essentially, they can use their own initiative and decide there's an area that will warrant investigation. I mean, what we see with national minimum wage compliance is HMRC taking a geographic approach. So they'll pick an area of the country and they will go and look at businesses in that particular geographical area. Now, I expect the FWA might take a industry, a sector-led approach and say, you know, we've heard some disquiet in this particular industry or in this particular, you know, part of the commercial environment. We want to go and have a look more closely at that. I imagine there needs to be a certain threshold for a formal investigation to actually be triggered. But the point is, they're going to have the power to go and start nosing, nosing around. So they're going to have a lot of scope to scrutinize and take action against employers. And we think the sectors that are going to be at most risk for unexpected visits from the FWA are going to be things like hospitality, retail, the gig economy, so those sorts of areas where, a lot of wages typically tend to be towards the lower end of the spectrum, closer to national minimum wage or simply at national minimum wage. But bear in mind, even if you're not necessarily in a high-risk sector, you can still be subject to an investigation. So you'll have that vulnerability there. So that sort of sets the scene, really, in terms of what the FWA is doing, what powers they've got. What about preparatory steps? Like, what sort of things can businesses be preparing? Have you got any tips there?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this stuff, hopefully, people are going to be aware of already, but it's always worth having a look at so that we're ready. And, when we're trying to give businesses tips on what to do, very often it's always about an audit. I mean, you'll probably have heard us say on many occasions, audit your workforce, see who you've got, whether that's in relation to, how long people have been with you, whether you've got contractors who might not be contractors. And this is really no different. So what we're saying is don't wait for enforcement, don't wait for an issue to arise. If you can, run a compliance audit, make sure that you know what's going on in your business. And in terms of the areas to focus on, obviously, we've got minimum wage compliance. And for those of, there may be a lot of businesses out there for whom that is just not an issue, but there will be a lot where minimum wage compliance is right. So, remember that this goes up each year. Don't get caught out in terms of what you have to pay for your pay reference periods. But also the thing to think about, which is where a lot of employers may get caught out, is any deductions that are being made. Peter's already mentioned there were some really big names where businesses fell foul of deductions when it came to those uniforms we've talked about. I remember Monsoon, I think Wagamama's was another one. But there are other areas where you might go, well, we don't make our people wear uniforms. But think about things like salary sacrifice schemes. That might be for pensions, that might be your cycle to work schemes. And if you are making deductions by way of salary sacrifice, this may well push your employees below the national minimum wage. So you can see there, that's an area where potentially it's very easily, you're very easily able to be inadvertently caught out. Also, think about things like unpaid activity. That's going to be something that will be looked at. So think about training. Now, a lot of businesses will say, of course, if we train you, we're going to pay you for the time spent on training. What about when you say to people, we need you to come in 15 minutes before your shift starts for setting up or closing down at the end of the day? There are a lot of businesses out there who will not be paying that bit. Their shift might be 8 till 6 or 10 till 2, all of that stuff. But generally, they want them in at 9:45 in order to do a handover, perhaps from a previous shift. If you are talking national minimum wage levels, you need to make sure that the pay is sufficient to cover that because it still counts as working time. If you've got a mobile workforce, depending on what you're doing, looking at travel between sites during the working day. Obviously, commuting to a place of work doesn't count as working time most of the time, but if you've got travel between sites to meetings, etc., that will all count in terms of the hours. So you're looking at pay there for that compliance. Holiday pay, as we said, the enforcement process will come over to the Fair Work Agency in due course, but have a look at your holiday pay calculations. And, this has been in a massive state of flux for many, many years, but you need to remember that paying for holiday needs to take things into consideration, like regular overtime and regular commission. All of that needs to be factored in. Now, from the 6th of April, so next week, a new obligation comes into force to keep records demonstrating compliance with statutory holiday entitlement, including the amount of leave and pay. Now, this is something that's not actually been advertised. You should be keeping the records anyway, but this is something that is actually coming in. And a failure to comply with that is going to be a criminal offence punishable by a fine. So check your HR systems to make sure you are compliant. And I did read somewhere, it's absolutely crazy, but the government apparently has data to show that holiday pay shortfalls amounts to just over £9 billion. So it's a massive area. Now, as I said, you're probably keeping records already. You're going to have holiday entitlements. You're going to have holiday booking systems where people need to get approval and it's all recorded. But I just wanted to give you a little bit more detail about what you need to keep the records of. So it's going to be the holiday taken, what pay's been made for those holidays and how that pay's made up. Is it base pay, commission, overtime, etc.? Keep a note of any holidays you've allowed employees to carry over. And you're going to have to keep records of where you've made payment in lieu of holiday, including any carried over holiday as well. Now, as I said, most HR systems will be geared up to do that, but it is always worth having a look at the check. I'm hoping that most of you will be going, oh, we're fine with that. We don't need to worry about it. So, fantastic. Another area is working hours and rest breaks. So nothing's changing the rules on rest breaks, daily, weekly rest, etc. None of that's changing, but it's going to be the complaint process that's changing. So employees wishing to complain about not being able to take their rest breaks, they go through that normal grievance process and then they take their complaint to the tribunal. They can report it also to the Health and Safety Executive. Now, it's quite interesting here because it's always been the case that the ability to take those rest breaks is something that the employee has to enforce, and that's going to be this big shift. The change now will be that the Fair Work Agency will take over enforcement of those working time rights in terms of those rest periods and breaks. So your best bet for showing compliance is obviously going to be having evidence. I know as lawyers, we're saying that all the time, have evidence to back up what you're saying. Make sure you've got a way of showing that you record the hours accurately. There are clear breakdowns of the payments you're making, and that you've got signed contractual terms which clearly state what an employee is owed. Thirdly, have a think about reviewing your pay practices. As I've said, higher risk areas for underpayments are going to be employees who have irregular hours. It will be those who work overtime, and looking at where deductions are being made from payments, such as if a previous overpayment of a bonus had been made, for example. So having a look around your pay is going to be is going to be critical, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're good tips for people to be thinking about. In terms of sort of other areas that you can do to try and head off an issue, I mean, we're always going to say prevention is better than cure. And if you've got an internal reporting system that encourages employees to raise issues early, then that's a good way of fleshing out whether you have an issue that needs addressing now. I know a lot of larger organizations will operate whistleblowing hotlines, for example. Of course, you're going to have a grievance policy in place. But outside of those things, there are still mechanisms to try and flush out. And I mean, there's a much wider, broader topic of discussion around employee engagement, around the use of employee forums and committees and engagement, if you're not a unionized environment. If you are a unionized environment, you're going to know about an issue because the unions are probably going to be all over it and going to bring it to your table. But I know a lot of you won't be. So I
Yet.
think, effectively, if you've got good employee engagement, you've got a good means of having your ear to the ground. And importantly, employees feel that they're able to raise things. You've got that environment where people are not fearful of bringing something to your attention. You're going to be in a lower risk category for sure, because you're going to have the opportunity to know and then deal with and address something, if you hear murmurings of an issue. Of course, you might encounter a situation where you hear an issue, you try and resolve it, and you don't agree, you're in disagreement. Well, at least you know what's coming and you know what your stance is going to be. But you don't want to be in that scenario where you're getting surprised by anything. You shouldn't be in a situation where you're being surprised by something, because you should have these various escalation mechanisms. So, having those things in place is hopefully going to mean that you can catch and resolve issues before the FWA, are anywhere near and need to get involved.
Yeah,
So
it
yeah,
gives you a
part of
chance to
it,
get your documents as well, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah, get
if
things in
you're alerted
order.
to it, yeah, you're going to
But
get the chance to have a look at it all.
it's a structural thing, isn't it? It's like, have you got the means in place for people being able to bring issues to your attention, whatever that is, grievances, employee forums that I've mentioned. But culturally as well, like what kind of working environment and cultural environment have you fostered? Like, do people feel empowered to be able to raise things, or are they worried about doing so for fear of retaliation of some kind? But where we've seen issues in the past, I mean, you mentioned some of those retailers as well. I can't imagine that they intended any wrongdoing. I mean, they wouldn't want to be named and shamed, and I'm sure they would say they wouldn't want to be underpaying their workers. They would say we really value our workers. So, what's going on there, Adrienne?
Well, I think this is the point. A lot of employers get caught out inadvertently. Like I've said, it's normally technical areas. And, I'd like to think that anybody on the call today is going to be absolutely in that bracket if they get caught at all and if this applies to them. There really is only a small number of this doing this absolutely deliberately. And it could well be that the Fair Work Agency has got them very firmly in their sights. When I had a quick look at the naming and shaming, there's a lot of things like fast food restaurants, etc., where typically there could well be issues around vulnerable workers. But what I would say though is it will make no difference whether you're meant to or not. If there's non-compliance, there's non-compliance, and significant penalties can be applied. And, not wishing to scare anybody, but they've said that the penalties that can be applied can be up to 200% of any shortfall. So there's a significant stick there, I think, that means that we do need to look at this stuff. And I think also just to keep an eye out on what additional areas of enforcement are going to be added to the power of the Fair Work Agency. So as I said, there's a lot of people here where national minimum wage isn't going to be relevant, but that's not the sole focus. There's other bits like this holiday pay, sick pay, etc., which it's very easy to make mistakes on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. We had a question that was in the chat just before we wrap up. Let's deal with that. So thank you, Karen, for your question. Karen asks, how does this, or does it include salaried employees who are assumed to work additional hours with no extra pay? Well, yeah, I mean, when you're looking at national minimum wage compliance, you need to be paying the national minimum wage for all hours worked. So this is an issue sometimes with what you perceive to be higher earners who end up working a really high amount of hours. And actually, when you average out an hourly rate of pay for the hours that they've worked, it brings them below. So that is a risk area. Now, what's the answer to that? You need to have an eye on a couple of things. You need to have an eye on the amount that they're working. I mean, there's a health and safety perspective with all of that, which obviously drives the working time regulations, is the words I was searching for. So you've got to think about working time regulations compliance. But yeah, it dovetails with national minimum wage compliance, because what you don't want to do is think, well, this person earns high enough that they're never going to be an issue in terms of national minimum wage. But it turns out they're working twice they're at the hours they should be. And actually, when you divide and do the calculation over the reference period, it turns out you're underpaying them. And employers have been caught out on that. I don't know if you've seen anything around that, Adrienne, at all.
Yeah, I think it's something that I raise generally when I look at, contracts might say your working hours are 9 to 5:30, but you're required to do such additional hours without additional remuneration. And most of the time, that's going to be fine when you're looking at higher salaries. Where I've flagged it is where I've looked at the salary level and thought, I'm not sure there's enough headroom in that lower salary to be able to make sure that that's compliant. And I think that's where it's going to be an issue. So it's a combination. If you've got people on the lower end of salaries and you've got that type of approach, then that's probably going to be something that you need to look at.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, that neatly brings us on time, or yeah, as the clock ticks round to 11:30. So thank you everybody for joining us today. I hope that was a useful session for you. We're going to be back in 2 weeks' time with another topic. I've had a couple of emails from you suggesting topics as well, so thanks so much for those. We will incorporate those topics in future 101 sessions. Just a reminder, you can get the video recording of all of our past sessions from the last 3 years, I think, on our website, and we're up to about 80 or so episodes on Spotify as well. So please do have a listen to those. If you get a chance, do rate us on Spotify, and we very much look forward to welcoming you back in a couple of weeks' time. In the meantime, have an absolutely fantastic Easter, everybody. Thanks very much for joining today.
Thank you. Bye.